Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. Meanwhile, please enjoy this encore presentation of Real Vision content.
Hi, I'm Nathan Egger from Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision encore presentation, we're bringing you an interview from August 2015, in which two previous Macro Voices guests, Grant Williams and Bill Fleckenstein, sit down for a one-on-one at Bill's home in Seattle. Grant and Bill break down the massive shift at the Fed, beginning with Alan Greenspan, a renminbi devaluation, and of course, Bill's successful track record in short selling. Also expect Bill to challenge your definitions of inflation and deflation. I hope you all enjoy this week's Real Vision Television encore presentation.
Phil Fleckenstein, thanks for having me back again. Well, it's always good to see you.
Thanks for coming to Seattle and seeing me.
Again, you give me great weather. You keep doing this for me. I appreciate it.
I'll always do it for you.
All right, I've got that on film now. Be careful. So there's so much stuff going on. We've picked a very good day to sit and have a chat.
Yeah, we have, actually.
We're talking the day after the Chinese devalued the renminbi. We're talking a week after the Chinese, or a month after the Chinese started announcing their gold holdings, and a day after they made another announcement. So there's so many things going on and so much to talk about. But let's kick off with the inflation-deflation debate, because it's something you and I have spoken about a lot over time. You said something very interesting to me before, and talking about this RMB devaluation, and someone said, you know, it's going to be a very deflationary event, and that's when your afterburners kicked in. So if I could just recreate that moment.
Okay.
What do you make of that RMB move and the likely effects it's going to have?
Okay. So before we talk about the impact, we have to make sure we all have the same terminology, okay? So inflation is when you buy things and they constantly go up over time. Sometimes they go up more, sometimes they go up less. Deflation is when the opposite happens. And for the life of me, I cannot believe anyone on the planet doesn't really want deflation. Do they really want their cost of living to go up? The fact that the central banks and most people are cheering for more inflation is, on its face, lunacy. What happens is the lexicon has been bastardized. So when people say deflation, they usually mean one of two things that connotates, you know, horror stories in their head. They're either using it as a code word for the depression in the 30s here in America, in which prices did fall, or they're discussing a bear market in asset prices. So a real estate bear market, a stock bear market, a bear market in commodities, that is not deflation. That is a bear market in asset prices. So for the when the Chinese decide to devalue by a couple of percent, in and of itself, all that means is imports just went up 2% in cost, depending on how anyone shuffles their prices. It also is probably a symptom of the underlying weakness. So the knee-jerk reaction is we see commodities get sold to some degree, but because people feel that the Chinese are telling you, hey, the numbers are worse than you thought they were, and GDP growth is not great. So I think we have to be really careful about how we're defining what's happening, and then we can discuss, okay, what is happening. So the China's weak. That's one of the reasons why they did all the goosing that they did of their monetary policies, and why they've ride the rescue when they've had their little crash over there so far, and now they're doing this. So they are pretty worried, I would say, the Chinese authorities.
So, but again, it comes back to something, again, you and I discussed at length before, the psychological component of all this, right? We've reached a point where central bankers have inserted themselves into the process to such an extent that people who spent their careers looking at markets, building frameworks within which they can evaluate potential price moves, now have to throw in this component of what are a bunch of guys in six rooms around the world going to decide to do for their own agenda. And so everybody's psychology is ragged because you've got to play this game. And yet, at some point, this psychological component has to break because this can't work. I mean, I think we all understand it can't work. You can't print money out of thin air forever, and it works. How do you see that psychological component standing at the moment?
Well, I mean, that is the multi-trillion dollar question, because to me, what holds all of the markets together as well as they have held together, be it debt, equity, or the, you know, tendential markets from there, real estate and all that, is confidence. And the confidence that people have in the Fed, for starters, is enormously high. And if you go back and look, for instance, the Fed has totally changed the way it operates since Greenspan took over. And they have been constantly in a position of mispricing the cost of money, always too low. And then, you know, we got one bubble and they tried to bail that out with more same policies. We had an even worse bubble. Now we've had even crazier policies, and we've got a cross of a bubble in bonds and stocks and real estate and all that. The reason it's worked is because people have confidence in the Fed. For a long time, they weren't sure it was going to work, right? And in the wake of both burst bubbles, there was a period where people lost confidence in the Fed, and then they eased, and it didn't matter. They did such a massive job of, when QE3 came on top of everything else, they drove the stock market to the moon. I'm speaking of the U.S. market. Driving the U.S. stock market to the moon was sort of like, that caused people to think, hey, these policies work. And therefore, the extension is, now they'll start to back away, they'll raise rates. I mean, they were talking about raising rates in March, and here it is August, and they haven't, and they probably won't in September either. So the people had so much confidence in their policies and the fact that they would work and they could exit, that they took the dollar to the moon, and all these things have happened. But they're all predicated on one thing, confidence, that it will work. And confidence is a very hard thing to lose, and it's even a harder thing to gain. And it matters so much more now than ever before, because in this activist central bank era that began with Greenspan, and especially in the last 10 years, especially in the last 6 years, the central banks are targeting asset prices to drive the economy instead of allowing the asset markets to be a reflection of the underlying economy. They've put the cart before the horse. Yeah. And in doing so, they create massive amounts of misallocated capital, more so now than ever before, because they're actively trying to do it. Before, it was kind of a byproduct. The fact that they can't learn their lesson is sort of shocking. But the fact that, you know, billions of investors the world over haven't learned any of the lessons is even more shocking.
But is this a lesson that they have to learn, or is this now a situation they've got themselves into where they may well have learned the lesson, but they can't do anything with that knowledge because it's just too dangerous?
Well, I don't think that the Fed has learned their lesson at all. I think they believe their own BS 100%. There's not an iota of doubt that they're pursuing the right strategies, in my opinion, based on everything they've said. And, you know, some people might not like to contemplate the thought that the central banks are in fact the problem and not the cure, because they might think that's too scary a thought. But that's never worked from an investment strategy. Oh, that outcome's too bad, I'm not going to think about it. When in fact, it might be the most likely outcome. So I don't think the central banks necessarily have their head in the sand. I think they're just that clueless.
But we've all been waiting for them to back themselves so far into the corner that they just can't get out. And it feels now that maybe they're there.
Well, if we took the Fed, since they're the lead sled dog in this whole process, they're trapped right now. They have committed to raising rates, and the premise was that what they'd done has worked and they'd be able to. And they've been able to back off from a March expectation to now September, although in the last couple of days, the probabilities of that has dropped to only 44%. And no one's questioned the efficacy of their policies. They've let them back off, and no one says, hey, wait a minute, if this all works, why are you having to back off? We haven't hit that point yet when psychology's changed. And we can't predict when it will. All we can do is be alert to the fact that, oh, it's starting to happen. And So I think the next couple of months are incredibly important because we had this shocker of a GDP, weak GDP report. Everyone says, it's just weather. And the second quarter wasn't that much better, but it was a bit better. And then they thought the third quarter and fourth quarter will be better. So now you've got a situation where the Fed has said, sorry, we're on a path to hike. Well, whether they don't hike or not, they're certainly not going to ease just yet. Market participants have expectations for the second half that are anywhere from big to huge. And same with different stocks, and the expectations for the earnings. So you've got a situation where people are expecting things to get drastically better. And in fact, they could get worse. At a moment in time, the Fed can't ride to save them. And you've got a market structure that is uniquely crash prone. So you've got a really dangerous mix in front of us right now. And the Fed is trapped in that they can't help the market. Now, they don't think they need to help the market, but they're not going to be able to until the market cracks quite hard. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen.
Well, we're coming into that time of year when these things seem to happen, right?
They just I have a theory about this.
Well, let's hear it.
So why is it that always are the dislocations are in the fall? And as a guy who's spent, 20 years more or less, even though I've been out of it for the last 6 years, running a short book, I've had a lot of time to think about this because you only make money in these small periods. And what I think is you get a situation where expectations get high. People have become complacent. Things have worked. So they got their guard down. Things, the economic numbers or the earnings reports don't come in quite as expected. People say, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. Because a lot of times there have been improvements in the second half or the things have picked up or whatever. And so they get to the fall and they're not better. And all of a sudden it's, you got the Wile E. Coyote trade, right? Things can get better. And then remember, report cards are coming out near the end of December. And more importantly, since so many people are in the hedge fund world, i.e. got a carried interest. That's what hedge fund really is. Let's call it what it is. Now people have to so everyone is forced to participate and they can't rationalize anymore. And then when the rug gets pulled out, it all goes at once. That's my pet psychology theory.
It's a perfect segue into the short selling space because it is something I really want to talk to you about because you've made a tremendously great short selling track record and you've been very good at picking your spots. And there aren't many short sellers I know who are inclined to, and more importantly, have the capacity to stay out of that business for as you've done 6 years. I mean, you closed your short fund March 2009, right? Yes. I mean, you couldn't have rung the bell any better.
I got
than
pretty
that,
lucky.
Right? Yeah, look, you do it once, it's lucky, you do it a few times. There's to be some kind of component of skill involved. But you're now talking about getting back into that business again. And so I want to understand, and that the viewers understand, the framework that says to you, hey, okay, now's the time that I want to be looking at this again. And then what am I going to do about that? How do I want to get involved on the short side?
Okay. So let me take a step back. As with most financial market lessons, I got to learn this one the hard way. And by that, I mean, so I was running a short only fund in the late 90s. And starting in the mid 90s. And part of my promise to investors was I would always be fully invested because this sounds quaint now, but in the mid-90s and even in the late-90s, people were afraid that if you weren't positioned, you were going to miss it. Because right. They were thinking of 87, and they were thinking of what happened in Japan, where the thing vaporized in about a year. So you had to be in place. So I said I'd be short. And it worked really well from, say, 96 through the fall of 98. I could be short. I'd get big drawdowns, but then I'd make it all back. And I was up way more than the market was down for that period until the fall of 98. And that's when Greenspan really, really took matters into his own hands when they gunned the tape on the back of Long-Term Capital blowing up. They said, okay, well, we'll take it back if we need to. And they never did. And they got off on this mission of ease, ease, ease. And so what happened to me was I got destroyed because I couldn't get out of the way. I was always going to be short. And I was not even short internet stocks in the internet mania. Right. Because I'd seen what happened to Japan. I'd been short Japan in 89, and I'd seen what had happened. I knew that once things got crazy, the next thing would happen is they'd probably get crazier still. And so that's not a good measure. And so what I was short in 99 in particular were beneficiaries of the Y2K silliness, whereby everyone had to buy new PCs, new servers, anything to do with technology all had to be redone. And so in 1999, in the second half, I'm short, Dell, Compaq, Gateway, and all these things. that where their business was going to like stop in 2000. And what happened was that because XYZ eyeball grabber got some, you know, multi-billion dollar valuation, then they wound up marking up the valuations of mundane companies like Micron and Dell and Gateway. And so PC vendors were selling at 40, 50 times earnings. And that didn't change until 2000 when the bubble burst. So what I had to do was I figured out that even in the mania, there were periods of time when you could make money that mostly had to do with around earnings season when you had catalysts. And it was only safe. So you could make money tactically, but it was only safe to really be short and anticipate trouble when the Fed was out of the equation.
Right.
Now, out of the equation is subjective because they can be not easing and still be a formidable opponent because people think they got their back. You need to have them either be trapped like they are now or to where the bubbles burst and they're easing and it's not working.
Yeah.
And that was the case, you know, 2000 to 2002, 2008, and it'll come up again. So fast forward to today. So in the period, so I changed my methodology to where I went to my investors and said, look, I can't be short all the time. I got to be able to be tactically short. And a big piece of that is, what is the Fed doing? What's the monetary condition? Is the Fed in control? Are they easing? Are they printing money? If so, you have to be super careful and you can only act when you have real catalysts.
But what was the response to that? I'm just curious as to whether, because people get funny about that stuff, right?
Well, I mean, I'd done so poorly. I went to my major investor at the time, which was Vulcan, which is Paul Allen's investment arm. And the man who ran the thing at the time, Bill Savoy, said, yeah, that's great. I mean, if you want to do that, that's fine. They gave me more money, and it all started to work out well in the end. And then I raised some other money. It all worked out fine for me in the end. But the important thing is I learned this lesson of what you can and cannot do, what's required. Short sellers are noted for doing great research. You know, Jim Chanos, I don't know this Muddy Waters fellow, but from what I've seen, he does a great job. So there are guys out there that do great research. Unfortunately, it doesn't mean much. You have to do it, but it doesn't mean anything in terms of actually making money. It's the application of, okay, how much exposure do I want? Do I need to press it? Do I need to take it off? It's the tactic. In my opinion, it's the tactics. Yeah. And so I closed the fund down in 2009 because I knew what the Fed was going to do. They were going to print money until they got a response that they wanted or until the markets took away the printing press. I thought maybe the latter would happen, but that has not been the case. And now we've got a situation where fast forward to today, the Fed's got themselves out of the picture. They can't rescue the market. The economy's sputtering, like we already discussed. I have a lot of targets that I can pick on from the short side, and bad news matters. So in Q1, I had a couple of shorts, but I actually had to cover them before they reported earnings because they had to report the bad earnings, then they go up. So in Q2, that sort of changed. Now bad news kind of matters. So I have the Fed out of the equation so I can manage risk from that standpoint. I don't have to worry about the random melt-ups like we happen to see the day before the Chinese devalued. You know, it was only a one-day wonder instead of being... So if you're short, you have to decide, is that what a one-day wonder or is it going to go on for a month? Yeah. You always have to make these tinkering decisions if you're not running a long short book and you're just running a short book. So now we have a situation where the Fed's out of the process. Expectations are high. The market's kind of crash prone. Bad news is starting to matter. And I think we got a boatload of bad news from the bottoms up standpoint. Now, if we get macro bad news on top of it, now you got a really fertile mix. So now is the time that I can actually manage the risk and try to make money. Now, my belief is that the market's going to crack hard and the Fed will come back with QE4. My idea is, we'll have to get out of the way anticipating that, and you take a step back and then you see how QE4 develops, how it goes, where psychology goes, and after that might be the real opportunity for a big secular bear market, assuming of course that people finally say these policies don't work and they start to take away the printing press or they don't believe that the central bankers will get their own way. It seems impossible sitting here today that people would not have faith in the central banks, but we've seen it, you know. We've seen a couple of periods in this decade post-bubbles. So
where do you, I mean, the obvious, people are going to look, if you say to people, okay, we think there's going to be a bear market, they are going to instantly look to the unicorns. They're going to look to Amazon. They're going to look to all these high-flying tech, to Facebook, Twitter. Where do you think, going back to 99, you stayed away from that stuff. Where do you think perhaps there's vulnerability here. Yeah,
you can't be short that stuff right now. Yeah. I mean, you might do it and get and look back and say, I did it and I won.
Right.
But if you were going to construct a portfolio, that's not what you would be in.
Right.
Because you still need, right now, as best we know, you need catalysts. So I need bad news specifically about certain companies. And that means as we get to earnings season, you can have positions. We're going to find out if this period between now and earnings season, if it's weak for the market, there'll be big information. It'll be the first time in the no news period stocks drifted lower instead of, you know, drifted higher because of the QE or the fumes of QE.
Yeah.
So, but where I'm focused is where I know there are technology companies where I know the business is no good, where their guidance is wrong. So I can start to manage my risk. A lot of the stocks have rolled over. So you have to have a technical component to run in a short book. You got to say, okay, well, you know, how am I going to get out? Where am I going to get out? Start to manage my risk. So if the charts have rolled over, you got spots you can pick based on what you think the other people that are long the stuff are liable to do. And then we've got catalysts coming up. So the question coming into this period right now is, can you start to build up shorts now and they start to work, or do you have to wait till we get closer? I don't know. Not to make too much out of one specific day, but I think today is quite interesting given that yesterday's ramp-rama fell apart. Now, is it purely because of what the Chinese said last night, or is it a function of what the market really wants to do? I don't know yet. But there's going to be a lot of problems in technology specifically, and that always gets people. Now, if the mainstream tech stocks get in trouble, and I imagine there's going to be problems at retail based on what we're hearing about retail sales so far. So there's going to be plenty of troubles. I like tech stocks because they often get mispriced. There's lots of data points because they have public customers and public suppliers. So it's a good place to go from a risk management standpoint, assuming you understand the industry.
So, but finding that sector that you think is not just right, but something you understand critically, which is very important, because
right.
People try and short stuff that they think is too expensive on. They don't really know why, but they keep reading that it's expensive, and they think when they sense there's a chance to short, they jump on those things, right? They don't really understand the companies. How do you branch that out? How do you build that little niche of the market and think, okay, this is now happening?
So you have to start with where you have identifiable catalysts, because you start out when you're in a period where things haven't worked for short sellers, unless you were smart enough to be short the oil patch, which I wasn't. I don't know anybody who did, but I assume somebody was. So let's say it starts to weaken in technology, like I say. There are going to be other things that weaken that maybe I'm not focused on. So that starts to happen. You can begin to triangulate a mosaic, and then you can see how the market trades the news. Ah, they're starting to worry about what's coming. You can get in front of the news. Well, then you can branch out to wherever you think, you know, I have another theme away from technology, and that is the mismatch of liquidity. So you've got entities promising daily liquidity, like fixed income bond managers, where there's not a prayer in hell they could get out of the positions if they had a get-out machine. You know what I mean? So there's a liquidity mismatch, and so I'm short Franklin Resources. I've been short for a year. I have nothing wrong with it. Not anything bad to say about the company. But they're promising daily liquidity in mutual funds that I don't think is going to exist. And it's reasonably expensive, and I've been short it for 8 months or so. Jim Grant wrote it up, got me thinking about the idea in the first place. And it's been a painless, slow dribble.
But that's really interesting to me, because it's being short of anything for 8 months.
It's the longest I've been short of stock in 7 years for sure. I kept a small position, because otherwise I would have traded around it and probably got left behind.
But that's another critical part of this, right? Getting the sizing right at the right time.
So that's another adjunct to the tactics, which I like to call, you have to understand the personality of the thing you're short.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to do that. That's why I never use ETFs. Because I have no research edge. I don't really know how the thing's going to trade. But speaking of ETFs and liquidity mismatch, I think, you know, BlackRock is an interesting consideration. Again, nothing against the guys at BlackRock, but I'm saying things 18, 19 times earnings, or maybe it's only 17 now. But what do they do?
Right.
I mean, I think there'll be an accident in ETFs, quite likely. So I get a free call on that. That I can manage my risk in the stock, so it'll go down with the market. It might get some acceleration. So it's... There are little pilot filler positions I might have, you know, based on this other idea. But I mean, where you can really put money to work and have a decent sized position, now you can manage the risk. And I think that's best done in these tech stocks, not the crazy ones.
Right.
Because what's the catalyst for something to go wrong at LinkedIn or Facebook or, you know, we can go through the whole list of them. Now, some of the high flyers have blown up. Last week, they got Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, and who else? Another big one got hammered. I can't remember. So some of the momentum names have started to have trouble. I don't watch them very close, as you can tell, because now, if the market, say the market breaks, and then people start to start smelling the coffee about the economy, some of those kinky ones have GDP sensitivity. And, you know, Tesla may be one of those. A stock, everyone with a valuation concern has wanted to short that one forever. Well, now maybe if China's got troubles and we got troubles, I mean, maybe they're not going to sell as many cars, but and maybe people are going to care that they didn't sell as many cars. That's the more important issue. So there was a, because the Fed is trying to get the stock market to drive the economy, if the stock market starts weakening the economy, then some of those high flyers, and so you could maybe build a catalyst case for certain ones of those based on disappointing GDP sensitivity. But those things have to start to happen before you can go after those big, expensive momentum names.
But if people start to get confident that they can short names like those, I mean, they've got a long way to fall, right?
Yes, but you have to ask yourself, what will make them confident? Well, what's got to happen is prices got to start down across another package of securities. And remember, you have to get the guys that own this stuff who feel bulletproof because they've been making nothing but money for 6 years and a lot of it. You got to get them a little worried, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, so that's a process and it's just kind of starting.
I remember I was working in New York in 1999, 2000, and I remember very clearly a conversation I overheard in the cafeteria there one day, and it was right when the market was breaking, but we didn't know it then. And I was standing there in line for a sandwich, and I heard two guys talking, and one of them said, "Dude, you see the market today? It's a big down day. Intel's getting crushed." And the guy's instant reaction, he put his tray down, and he said, "This is my chance to get in. I've been waiting for a chance for ages." And he literally left his lunch and went back upstairs to call his broker and buy some stock. So you've got to get past that stage of the mentality, right?
Exactly.
Which is a tough thing to get past.
And, oh, I know. And that, I can't believe I forgot this because I think it was such a big deal. That's why it was so interesting what happened to Apple. Okay. Apple is the stock, probably the most loved stock in the English-speaking world.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look super expensive on the surface based on the multiple, whether it's 14, 15, some number like that. And yet, they finally stubbed their toe in that they didn't build as many units in the last quarter that got reported. And lo and behold, the stock got torched. And it even broke the 200-day moving average. Now, I don't happen to think any moving average is the cure for cancer, right? They're just reference points to whether the market's trending one way or not in the short term, long term, whatever. But I think a lot of people have come to really think those things are important. So I thought it was going to be a very important piece of information as to how it traded when it hit the 200-day moving average. It went smashing through it, broke hard, tried to bounce, and now it looks like it's failing again. Well, I think that matters because your man in the cafeteria, if he's taken in on water on his Apple position, the stock that could not go down because people thought it was bulletproof. Oh, by the way, they got $200 billion, going to buy back all the stock. People thought it could never go down. And that's a function of, oh, that starts to change psychology. Wait, Apple went down. You know, something else goes down. So all of a sudden, they start losing money. It gets cumulative. Then the bravado starts to go away. Then if guys want to get rambunctious on the short side, maybe that can... But short sellers don't really make the market go down.
No.
It's the longs getting out. It's the lack of buyers, right? Stocks gap. They gap more violently down than they gap up. I mean, we've seen some gap ups in the Momo stocks here. That's more like late cycle activity. But when they gap down hard. And people don't realize that. You don't need any trades to have the stock go to zero.
Right, exactly right. And this is, we've seen these flash crashes. We had one in the treasury market, for God's sake. We had one in the dollar.
Right.
I mean, that's telling you something. And that's a warning.
Well, that's why I go. I mean, I have said many times in the last couple of years, the market's crash prone. And I understand that that's a low probability event. Crashes don't happen very often. However, I think that the structure that we have in the market today, you couldn't have made it more crash prone if you actually tried. We don't really know how these algos work. I think they tend to be momentum oriented, but we don't know for sure what's going to happen when the tape starts down. You've had the other non-computerized traders sort of jumping on the trend. You've had all the mom and pops who are willing to be involved in the stock market jump on the trend. But on the downside, the trend won't be going up. So you'll need people who want to buy the dips. Well, I mean, will there be that many? What are the computers going to want to do? We know market making is going to not exist because of Dodd-Frank, both in fixed income and equities. So you've got a recipe, and the what's it going to be like when the ETFs get liquidated and they've got to be, you know, puking stocks, and we could see some real dislocations there. So because what you get is indiscriminate selling when you've got these automated programs. And we haven't even seen a taste of that. As you pointed out to me, you know, when we were talking earlier, on the way up, there are always some sellers from somewhere, but that doesn't mean there's always going to be buyers on the way down. And that's the thing that people don't understand. It's sort of asymmetric how they move up and down.
Well, and they haven't had to worry about it for some considerable time. And I think the lessons that have been learned since 07 by a whole generation of people are very bad lessons to have learned.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, let's face it. If you had started in the business in 98, when Greenspan really got active, you've only still seen maybe 3 years of crummy stock market. And the rest of the time, you've made money just by showing up to work and, you know, coming up with any reasonable, you know, or non-reasonable strategy. So it's 15 years you win and 3 years you lose. And so you decide, well, I believe in the central banks. They're right. So the market has warped the thinking about that. That doesn't change the facts that it's bad policy. It's not going to work. But when you talk about crowd psychology, it can go on longer and go higher and forever. Sorry, I mean, it can't go on forever, but it can go on longer and higher than you can imagine. And that's kind of where we are. These policies have convinced a whole generation of investors that this is exactly what is a sane policy and successful. And so there's a lot of people that don't have any information in the database about how it really works.
Right. So do you think we can go back to a long, grinding, secular bear market in equities? And if so, what happens? Because we've got bond market at all-time highs as well. What happens?
I don't know. I'm 100% certain I know this. These policies don't work. You don't even have to be slightly skeptical to see that they don't work. We don't have much GDP growth for all the money that's been printed. Yes, they've got unemployment down, but you know, you got a lot of people holding down three jobs because the one job's not paying enough. So it's not really a success even on that score. Now, some of that's been messed up because of Obamacare, but we have to play the hand that we get to get dealt. So QE doesn't work. So the question is, what is going to make the bond market decide these policies don't work? Because ultimately, it's the bond market that's going to decide that the central banks can't monetize the government debts. That's what QE is, right? Out-and-out monetization. And some people say it's not monetization because the money didn't get turned over in the banking system. No, it was monetization. It just didn't go down the path that it's gone down other times. It might go down the path down the road or it might not. Psychology changes. People start to say, hey, wait a second. Shrinking everything I buy at the grocery store is inflation. Healthcare is going up. Education's going up in price. Rents are going up in price. Maybe there's more inflation. Maybe we're in a stagflation period. Maybe it's not really inflation. Maybe it's 3 or 4%, you know, inflation and 0% growth. Whatever you want to call it, none of that is a recipe to say, especially when we're actively trying to make our currency weaker and promote inflation. None of that is a recipe for wanting to own fixed income. Right. Especially, for instance, JGBs, where they're only paying you 40 basis points to begin with. So the ultimate decision maker in this whole thing is going to be the fixed income markets. The way things are set up now, it looks like the equity market here is set to crack. If that cracks, they'll come back and have QE4, as I described. Then we'll see what the fixed income market says. If the fixed income market ever says, you can't use the printing press, we will have deflation. But until they can, I mean, actual deflation.
Real deflation.
And probably a depression too. So depression and deflation. But if the fixed income market doesn't stop them, we'll get some blend of them. I mean, we can't really say. To try to understand what's going to happen with QE4 is trying to look at the event horizon of a black hole and figure out what's going to happen, right? I mean, just like nobody knows how the post-QE period is going to go because it's never occurred before, ever, ever, ever. So you can say money printing doesn't work and it's going to fall apart. The market's going to fall apart, which I've thought. But the fumes of QE, you know, as the balance sheet doesn't run down the $4 trillion that the Fed owns. So they're continually monetizing at the margin, which may explain why the market's held up as well as it has, even though the economy's sputtered. You know, the free money the Fed hands out affects the financial markets far more drastically than it does the economy.
So you brought up something in the middle of that I want to go back to, and that's you're talking about weakening the currency. Now, we're in the middle of a raging dollar bull market. Right? I say we're in the middle of it. Are we at the middle of it? Is it got further to go? Because a lot of guys, including Raoul, my partner in Real Vision, is adamant and lays out an incredibly convincing case as to why the dollar is going to go 20-25% further. Where do you stand on that?
The guys that have the bullish dollar case have a convincing argument, especially on its surface. Okay. However, the dollar had an extraordinary move that sort of peaked out in March, at least for now. And it rallied, I don't know, 20-25% in, say, 6-7 months' time. You know, is that the start of a new bull market, or is that some epic one-off short-covering rally as everyone decided the Fed's done it? I believe the dollar is the currency market equivalent of the SPOOS. The fact that the Fed got the stock market high enough in America convinced enough people that the economy would be strong, that they could exit, we'd be on our way to normalcy, and oh, by the way, the dollar benefited from that because everybody else was going to have to go through the other path first and we were coming out. If that's false, if that is just a fantasy, which is what I believe, because the premise is wrong, i.e. the Fed hasn't accomplished what they want to, and they're going to be seen for that, then we're going to have a moment of real awakening in the FX market as well. Now, if the dollar's going up because of the embedded short that so many people think exists, and there's mechanical reasons that don't have anything to do with my reason, then I'll be wrong and the dollar bulls will be right. But if I'm right, and it's a fantasy that's been driven by stock market beliefs, then the end of the rally the peak we saw in March could have been the end of the rally. Now, when you talk about the dollar index, it's not representative because it's got such a huge weighting towards the euro. And everyone likes to laugh at the euro and Mario Draghi, and we've all poked fun at whatever it takes and all that. But the fact of the matter is, I could make a bullish case for the euro because you could say, well, yeah, they fight and they make all this noise out in public and they change the rules, but they have rules that have to be changed. And the Germans fight it, and so you could at least say, well, at least they have to have a fist fight to do anything, and they move the goalposts slowly. Therefore, I would rather own the euro than the dollar. Now, they're both just pieces of colored paper. And the only thing that has them to have any value is the confidence that people have in the central banks behind them. So if we start to lose that, who knows where it all goes. But I think I'm in the minority when I say, versus other people who have opinions about this, who you think, you know, have had a good historical track record of understanding things, when I say the dollar's probably finished. Because I think most guys think that it isn't. And I understand the arguments, and the arguments are compelling. But they also sort of imply, if they use any historical data, that the world's like it was. And I'm not saying the world is different, but the what the central bankers do is totally different, and the way that impacts psychology is totally different. So there may be another variable at work that makes the bullish analysis not play out, but we'll see.
Well, that's the beauty of it. I mean, and it's funny, we talk about all this stuff, and we've talked about the psychology component, and this whole idea of getting the stock market up to take the economy with it just shows you how far through the looking glass we've gone. Right?
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, the first person who noted that does work after fashion was Soros when he first started talking about reflexivity. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember when I first read it, I thought, oh, that's nuts. But the more I've been around and the more I saw it, I mean, it didn't take me long to figure out. So normally what would happen is you have a healing economy. The market anticipates that because it was the wisdom of the collective masses, not the button that some monkey at the Fed pushed, right, that are deciding things are getting better. And so the market starts to go up. Companies can issue equity. They can repair balance sheets. They got capital for new businesses. And so the market was a positive feedback loop, and people picked up on that. Now they've tried to take it from a positive feedback loop to the horse that's supposed to drag the economy. And when you do that, since you spray money out indiscriminately, you're going to get lots of misallocated capital. And if you have no idea if you're going to hit the right targets, which if you are looking at what's happened in the world since 2008 from the perspective of a middle class, above middle class, or less than that person, it's been horrible for the most part. Now, some cities you can get lucky because, and you know, they're close enough to the stock market, even if they're stock market towns, or like Seattle has become kind of a stock market town because of Amazon and some of the other success stories. People close to that can do well. But other than that, people are struggling because what we've really had is a mild case of stagflation so far. Weak GDP growth, commensurate measure of inflation, and that's why people are hurting.
But the bizarre thing to me is, again, we've spoken about this, that the fact that people are now concerned that the stock market may crack and take the economy down with it. So what these guys have managed to do by juicing the market is actually make the entire economy now dependent upon the levers and the buttons they're pushing, which is, you wouldn't have thought it would be possible to create that environment, but it kind of feels like they have.
No, they have. And I don't think there are very many people that examine the policies at the Fed. It's like, damn the four torpedoes, full speed ahead. You know, we just jawbone the markets to wherever we want them, we'll ease. And people don't realize that it's all contingent on the confidence that the people have in them. And we're coming up to a juncture where it's going to be possible to see that the policies don't work. Now, how far is the pendulum going to swing in terms of lack of confidence? I don't know yet. The farther it swings, the more impact it's going to have. It seems preposterous to me as we sit here and discuss this that we could have the disproportionate percentage of investors thinking these policies work.
Right.
You know? I mean, but look, the Fed, we talked about this earlier. You know, the Fed thinks that it helped the Depression be worse because they didn't do enough, when in fact, they helped create the bubble that's led to the Depression because of the policies they did leading up to it. None of these guys have seemed to have read any history books. You know, Bernanke supposedly wrote a paper about this, and he got the exact wrong conclusion. So how smart is he? You know, I mean, they don't ever talk about the recession of 2021 that was even worse from a statistics standpoint, where they did nothing to help, and it created a boom that followed, as opposed to what we did in the 30s. So it's all there in history. All you got to do is read a few history books, and you'd know exactly. So if you made everybody read these history books before they could buy one share of stock or anything else, maybe we wouldn't be in this mess.
Well, you're saving the time. Just have one conversation with Jim Grant, right? And he'll tell you all you need to know.
The man who knows more about monetary history than any 100 people combined on the planet.
But at the middle of all this stuff, right, sits gold. And this is something I know that...
Gold?
You remember that thing, the pet rock?
Oh, that. Oh, the one that's doomed.
That's the one.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's sitting there in the middle of all this sturm and drang all the way around it, right? And it's not acting how you would think it should. Now, is that merely a reflection of how screwed up everything else is, or is there something else going on?
I wish I could answer that question. Anyone who's had anything constructive to say about gold in the last several years feels like a complete idiot, because the world is pursuing the exact policies that if you had known they were going to pursue them in advance, you would have said gold's going to go into orbit. And then you could look at the geopolitical stuff and everything. You'd say, well, how many zeros is after the first 100, right? Is it just one, or is it two more? Is it 10,000? So anyone who's had anything constructive to say feels like a moron. All right, so let's get that out in the open. And there's a big contingent of people who probably don't know the first thing about mining gold or the cost of production or the number of tons, and they all feel like geniuses because they sell it every day and it goes down. Doesn't matter how spurious the reason. The Fed's going to tighten in March, sell some. Oh, the Fed's not going to tighten until April, sell some more. They're not going to tighten until September, sell more. So, all right. Why has that happened? I don't know, but I'll go back to my point about psychology. The best rationalization explanation I can come up with is as follows. They printed so much money in QE3. Let's say that the market correctly, the gold did go from 200 to 1900 for 12 years in a row, so it's not like it didn't do anything. Right. Let's say that at that point, unbeknownst to those of us who still owned it, that the market had discounted QE3, discounted the negative possibilities of QE3. As QE3 unfolded, it finally was big and bold enough that it really got the equity market here to go. That was the same time Draghi came in and started to quasi follow up on whatever it takes. So you had the ECB and the Fed, and they got things going enough to where people started to say, hey, maybe it might work. And gold was going down for maybe it needed a correction, maybe it was going to have a bear market. And it collapsed to, say, 1,300-ish, two and a half years ago. When it's kind of been going sideways. But the last pukage has been in this part where the dollar went to the moon on the back of the S&P, that bit of psychology. So maybe you have what was going to be a correction or a bear market anyway, get exacerbated or exaggerated to the downside because of this huge overconfidence the Fed has solved the problem. And then when you layer on top of that, the biggest brain teaser of all, which is we printed so much money, we collapsed the price of oil. Because you got rates on quality bonds low enough that the junk debt was cheap, that all the wildcatter and guys in the oil patch says, well, I don't have to sell equity. I can borrow money at 5%. I'll do that all day long because oil is always going to go up. So you had a perfect environment to get that misallocated capital into this one market that was a rig job to begin with. The Saudis decided they weren't going to rig anymore because they had to get rid of these guys. So then you have oil collapse. They say, wow, this money printing not only drives markets up, it doesn't even create any inflation. And in fact, it's deflation. No, it's not deflation, but it's the term people use for it. So now you had oil collapse and you had commodities tanking, most likely because China and the world's weak, and you know, grains are an ag cycle, a weather cycle as well. So you have all that and people decided, wow, there's nothing wrong with printing money. It works, doesn't create inflation. Get rid of this crap, right? And what's also interesting is that if you look at the ETFs, the gold ETF has lost, the US one, lost about half of its holdings in the last few years. The silver ETF hasn't. So the really super big-brained people that run institutions that can rationalize all this shit and pay, you know, giant multiples for things, they're getting rid of theirs. The public, who bought it for a different reason, maybe to protect themselves, which they bought silver because it's cheaper and people like their money, they like to own more ounces rather than the same dollar amount, has done well. So perhaps that's an explanation. It was just the end of the bear market was a function of just the supreme confidence in central banks. So now we're coming up to a moment where they may be about to lose that on the part of the Fed. From a short-term standpoint, you got record shorts in terms of the small specs and the large specs, and the commercials, you know, are really low on their shorts. So you've got a technical setup and you've got policies that we know don't work. And now maybe the wheels are coming off in China. And then lastly, as you noted earlier, yesterday the Chinese central bank, first of all, a month ago, they out of the blue after 6 years, they said, hey, guess what? We own more gold than we used to.
Sell it, right?
Yeah. People that had been looking for them to tell us that probably were disappointed at the amount, and the gold got sold that day, as a matter of fact. Now, a month later, they're telling us they bought more. So I said to myself, why are they telling us that they're accumulating gold? Well, part of the reason was because they wanted us to know something was up on the positive side after they devalued last night. So maybe those two are probably connected. But it seems to me that if next month they buy more gold, the next month they're telling you we're buying gold and they don't mind if the price goes up, which probably means they own a lot more than they've admitted to already.
Right. Yeah.
And they've encouraged their public to buy gold. So it seems to me that you have an asset class that is so uniquely hated. The guys that are the smartest guys in the rooms are just the people with a ruler that drew a trend line and says it's going to there. And it might, because it's just a price and it can be an emotional trade. But other than that, everything is set up for it to like one of the most incredible opportunities of all time, in that I've never seen anything this hated.
Right. Right. I mean, that's the way of these things. But that's what guys look for. I mean, you're starting back with the short fund again. On the flip side of that, as you said, you've got a setup here on the long side, potentially in the gold mining stocks, that could actually work really well. How do you look at the mining stocks?
Well, I mean, at the moment in my little fund that I manage for my friends and family, I mean, I'm short, and I'm about 40-50% short, and I'm about 40-50% long the miners. I got that position built up recently, and I'll be honest with you, I'm scared to death. These things dropping 3-4% a day when gold would be down a dollar. Yes, of what's going to happen is down 50. And so if you look at, I can buy an ounce of gold or I can buy a miner in the ground, assuming you've got, you know, a company you trust, the reserve and all that. Miners versus the price of gold from a net asset value or or reserve standpoint have never been cheaper. And that's been the case now for months. They just keep getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And of course, just like too expensive doesn't stop them from going up, being too cheap doesn't stop them from going down, except usually you get corporations that'll be in doing stuff and people will be buying, except in the case of gold, where the whole industry's so wounded, nobody really wants to make an acquisition. And a lot of the companies are, you know, don't really have anything that greater. But the big ones, I mean, they're all trying to, you know, fight a rearguard action. So you've had the situation where these gold stocks have gotten incredibly cheap. Now, I believe that gold is essentially an investment that correlates with lack of confidence in central banks. That's the only, you only buy gold out of fear. Fear for your life, you have to flee, or fear for an outcome, or fear of your currency losing value. It's a fear of outcomes. I don't mean like you're paranoid, but you're saying, hey, this is going to end badly. I need to have this to protect myself. They can't print it. And if you held that thought for 12 years while the early stages of central bank nonsense went on, it stood you in good stead. Now that they've really gotten loony, it hasn't worked. I think it's going to work in spades, but until it does, uttering that thought out loud and on camera feels pretty dumb.
Yeah, no, and history, recent history has proved it to be correct.
Exactly.
But we've got an understanding of your short selling framework. How do you keep sane, and how do you trade mining stocks? Because I know a lot of people out there struggle because they are such emotional things.
Yeah. So what I started to do was, I was a lead director of Pan American Silver for about 15 years. So I know a decent amount about the mining business. I don't really know much about geology or drilling, but I mean, I understand the business. And the tactic that so for a long time when I was favorably disposed towards gold, I mostly just owned gold or silver or both. And sometimes I had miners and sometimes not. And there was a long period where I would hardly own them at all because they really weren't making the kind of money because the cost structure really impacted them when we had the deflation from 07 to 012 and everyone's costs went through the roof. Costs going through the roof is not deflation, by the way, just to make that point again. So I was only involved with gold. Then in the last year and a half, you know, they started to get cheaper and cheaper, and I would sort of trade them like I did shorts, vice versa, where I'd have to have a get-out place. So with my shorts, I always have to have a risk management for every stock. Okay, if it starts to do this, I'm getting out, or what do I expect? And so I would buy them, puke them. And I managed to not lose an enormous amount of money. Now, is the next go-round going to be different than the last upcycle in gold if something happens? It could be. You know, these managements get abused, but I think a lot of them have gotten religion. A lot of them are really good. Good at managing their business. It's a tough business.
Sure.
Gold is expensive for a reason.
Yeah.
It's not cheap to produce. So I know the people that love to hate it, they love to hate it because they think that when gold does well, their beloved stock market won't go up. And to some degree, that's true. But it's a rare thing. It's not like green paper that they print up to monetize debts with. So that psychology has to change a little bit. It doesn't have to change much, I don't think, to get gold to start moving positively. And I don't want to sound stupid, but if you start to get gold to go like this, they're going to take all the reasons we have and they're going to invent more about why it should go up. So I think the miners are so ridiculously cheap that if you buy well-managed ones that have properties in the right parts of the world, like North America and maybe Mexico also, you probably can, if my theory is correct about confidence mattering, and if it's what's going to happen is going to happen, people have to abandon this, the Feds solve the equation problem, you might make 100% in a miner and only make 25% on your shorts, right? So if the psychology is as I suggested, there's more opportunity to be made in the miners than there are in shorts, but we don't know if that psychology is where. So you can have a theory and you put on your little tester kit and it starts to work, you can go with it, and then you have to keep, you know, you have to make sure you're continually right because both of these tend to be a little more speculative endeavors. Now, if you're just going to buy some gold to have in case the world comes to an end and you own your bullion, you just put it away and forget about it. I mean, the bullion that I have, I don't even think about.
Right.
It's like house insurance, as people like to say. But so I think you have to have an active management. And then you have to also, as the psychology changes, it may be easier to own them. I mean, you know, I don't know what's going to change psychology, but maybe sometime people would say, well, geez, I can go spend $100 billion and own all the public miners on the planet and I'd own the world's gold supply forever.
Right.
Now, if I was a Chinese guy, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah.
Now, we know the U.S. government would never let them come in and buy our miners, but maybe they would. So, you know, we'll see. I think we're at an inflection point for equities and we also are for precious metals. It's all the same confidence trade, just the other side of the same coin.
So I've been here in the U.S. the last week or so and I got to watch the Republican debate, which to an outsider is just fascinating.
It was fun to watch, I gotta say.
Right? What's your takeaway from that? Because I think some really important things are happening on a political level, or not just in America, around the world, but this is a real flashpoint.
You can't, talking about politics is a great way to alienate people. You can have, nasty debates about stocks, sure, and being bearish or bullish, but I hate political correctness. It's my number one thing. I was certain after the terrorist attack that we had, 2001, that, okay, that was going to blow the cover off political correctness. We were all going to roll up our sleeves, get together and work. And the next thing you know, they're frisking 80-year-old grandmothers and 10-year-old kids. So I was dead wrong about that. Political correctness has only gotten worse. The part of my favorite part was when Trump stands up there and says whatever he wants because he doesn't care.
Right.
So I'm hoping that trickles through and we get less political talk out of the politicians. And I think there was a bit of that in the debate. I think there was a whole handful of Republican candidates that had intelligent financial policies. And that's something that we haven't seen. I mean, John McCain was a war hero, Bob Dole was in it. But I mean, they were just the same empty suits as the other side. And the other side had a little more personality. And we got Bubba and Obama. So what I hope doesn't happen is we don't have a Clinton Bush.
Right.
Because, we're not supposed to have royalty in this country. That's kind of the idea, right? Yeah. And so I think the economy and the stock market are going to dictate the next presidential outcome.
Well, which is my point.
So everyone says it's going to be Hillary. Maybe not. I mean, I don't know who else they might run. But if what we think starts to happen and then they do QE4 and then we get some bad fallout from that and the markets are in turmoil, it could be anybody from the Democratic Party. And we need a crisis in this country to solve the long-term problems. The out-of-control, unfunded liabilities are only going to get larger the more we pretend that they are under control. Look at every city that's gone through bankruptcy, and there haven't been that many, but there's been a bunch. There's going to be more next time. And ask these people, would you have preferred we just started to dealing with this 10 or 15 years ago instead of making it worse? And that's the problem. That's an unintended consequence of the insanity of the Federal Reserve, where they allow everyone to continually kick the can until you get to Greece where there is no way out. They've been in a depression for 6 or 7 years, and they're going to be in one until they take the drachma back, probably.
Yeah.
And we're on that path. Now, we're not them, and there's things, but we're also enormous. And Japan's on that path. And every time I look at JGBs yielding 38 basis points, given their policies, I say, no matter how crazy you think it is here in America, JGBs yield 38 basis points this morning. And they want 2% inflation, and they've already taken the yen from 85 to 125. So maybe the Japanese JGBs go first. I don't know, But the wild card in all of this is, when do the bond markets say no mas to the central banks?
But this James Carville's quote that is the economy stupid, and he's right. And yet, there wasn't much discussion about the economy realistically in that debate. It wasn't really about that when it perhaps should have been. But over in the UK now, we have a leadership election going on for the Labour Party, which is the left of the spectrum. And there's a guy who's front running, like Trump is here, who is out of the box. He's a left wing. He wants to renationalize industry. And his economic plan revolves around something called People's QE, where because QE has been so successful and hasn't caused any problems for the last 5 years, why don't we have another round of QE and give the money directly to the people and build infrastructure, build housing, and build, right? This is the next knock-on danger of QE.
Yes.
Its success creates a monster.
Well, it does two things. It allows you to kick the can.
Yep.
And then if you don't get penalized for those policies, you do something even wilder. Now, I kind of think if we get to people's QE, the bonds markets might finally revolt, but we'll have to see. I'm not shocked to hear that. I wouldn't be shocked if the Fed did some variation of that theme. I mean, the Fed guys did a paper in 2001, 2 or 3 somewhere about looking at a stamp tax, whereby you had to use your currency in X amount of time or you'd have to pay it in a tax, right? In other words, spend it or lose it for sure. I mean, some variation of those policies will cause them to lose the bond market, I think, because then they're going to, they're trying to, if they could, they would legislate inflation, right? Because they think inflation means good, deflation means depression, that's bad, and they don't know anything about any of those things. Well, when you have a fiat currency and an ability to run big deficits, to think they're not going to have inflation is pretty difficult. Now, it might not show up exactly where you think. It's not at the pump right now. you know, but it's in rents. But we don't, you know, first of all, they took housing out of the CPI and they put in rents. And then they put housing back in, but they ask you what you think your house would rent for. So they're not really looking at rents either. And then there's hedonic. So the CPI is a worthless mechanism in order to try to measure inflation because of the quality adjustments that they make. So the question really is when people's mindset changes about a non-deflationary outcome, let's call it that.
But the problem, okay, so you've got Trump with 23% leading the polls, which baffles people.
Right.
You've got this guy, Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, leading the polls there, which baffles people. And you've got in a survey in the UK, 67% of people in favor of renationalizing certain industries like the railway. This is all connected.
Yeah, well, it is because the supposedly great recovery we've had has been extraordinarily bifurcated. The people with money have made a lot of money. Maybe some of us skeptics haven't done as well as the other guys, but the average person has done poorly because it's a stagflationary environment. It's not anything great. And so I'm guessing that's what the 67% shows for that guy. And we'll have to see if that continues. I think Trump is, remember the Network movie from the 80s? I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I think there's an element of Trump in that Trump. I think most people who might be inclined to say they're going to vote, there's a difference between saying we're going to and actually doing it. And enjoying the fact that he stands up and says, hey, look, I paid all these other guys money and they do whatever I want. Now, who didn't say, yeah, you actually said that, and willing to say things that are politically incorrect? You may not agree with his exact policies on immigration, but he's willing to say, hey, look, this is what we ought to do. And he's not trying to couch it. So I think there's a contingent of people that like the fact that he's calling a spade, and let that Trump, pun intended, the fact that some of his policies are crazy, or maybe he can't be elected anyway. It's the early days. And so what I think they're voting for is, let's have an honest debate. Now, some people are doing that. Other people don't want an honest debate. No. So I think they're kind of tapping into people. The ones that want an honest debate are willing to be much more vocal about it now. So it appears that he's got much more, you know, carrying power, staying power than he probably really does. This is not really about what he's going to do. This is about what he's saying right now. And people, they kind of like it to some degree, or they really hate it. But
yeah. Well, I definitely don't want to finish on politics. So just in closing, just a little sense of a few of the things that going into this fourth quarter, which we think
third
could
quarter.
Be third quarter earnings. Well,
third quarter
into
earnings,
fourth quarter.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
The things that you think, the signposts that you're looking for, things that you think may be catalysts.
Okay. So I think the important things are going to be what are the companies saying? You know, has it gotten worse since? Because the guys who reported later, now I'm talking about the companies that had problems. The guys who reported later said that July was getting worse than June and June was worse than May, and we're supposed to be going the other direction. So if the next group of companies report, have things gotten worse? That'll be useful to know. Is the market reacting harshly to negative news? Is it sort of taking neutral days and sliding the market as a whole, which it hasn't done in the past? So you get a sense that, hey, the thing is weakening and bad news is mattering, and you find out there's more bad news coming. And then if the percentage of people expecting a Fed rate hike in September starts to go down, now people are getting the message that the economy is probably too weak, and how does that all feed together? And so that's how you can build a short book. On the long side of gold, it'll be the confidence in the Fed as that comes down, and how does gold start to react to the news? Does it finally react to news that it has totally ignored the fact that the Fed was supposed to hike in March? Everything that's come out that says the Fed can't go when it's going to go hasn't helped gold one iota. Matter of fact, it's made it go down because the good news didn't work. So does it start to respond differently? So how the markets respond to the news, and is the news getting incrementally in the direction you expect, gives you more confidence that you're right and you can do more and things like that. But I think it's going to be what the companies say more so than the economic data, because the jobs data is a joke. So you really got to look to the companies to tell you what's going on, I think.
Perfect place to leave it. Bill, okay. As always, great pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for doing it, Grant. It was fun.